Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It is a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the invitation and this opportunity to discuss economic growth in Europe in a new light, and this new light hopefully benefits from the policy work which I had the chance to do at the European Commission. I should also congratulate on the 50th anniversary of InterEconomics Journal, because that's the occasion which brought us here together. What I'm going to say about economic growth, especially in the context of European imbalances and inequality, I prepared during the weekend, and I'm emphasizing this because sometimes we may have the habit to prepare the presentation during the keynote speech, which would be too bad today if it was the case. So I believe that indeed, as we heard in the introduction, it's extremely important and interesting to explore the connection between income inequality and economic growth. There are many researchers, but also institutions, are doing that in these days. But before arriving to this second part of my presentation, let me reflect a little bit about economic growth in general, why we discuss growth today and in what context, what are the main scholarly inputs to the study of growth today, and what are the European specificities? Because surely this discussion on growth is quite different. It's bound to be different in Europe than in the United States or elsewhere in the world. Slow growth has been a concern for quite some time. It's not a new issue on the agenda. Nevertheless, the explanations of slow growth have differed in different periods. In fact, when the problem itself came in the early 1970s, the first emphasis was on the resource constraints, that the depletion of raw materials, energy sources would result in a general economic slowdown as measured in GDP. And obviously, this aspect of low growth with the emphasis on the resource constraint comes back repeatedly to the extent that sometimes participants of this debate stress the positive side of the slow growth and even conclude that low growth, no growth, or degrowth is desirable. It's not a problem, it's not a challenge, but in fact, that's the future that's coming, and we need to adjust to that and focus on the quality of our economy and society instead. On the other hand, there are two other directions of thought. One recently summarized by the American economist Robert Gordon, who I would say is giving an explanation from the supply side, emphasizing the supply constraints, stressing that in about 1970, a special century of high growth ended, in fact, the technological innovations of our times are less revolutionary than those before. Productivity grows slower as a result, and we have to accept a lower rate of growth as a result. And then again, others stress the demand side constraints, most notably Larry Summers, former Harvard president and former Treasury Secretary of the U.S., focusing on the coincidence of income inequality, low inflation, a bias for savings, and coming up with the phrase secular stagnation. One way or another, these theories and these approaches are exploring the same phenomenon that in the last nearly four decades economic growth has been much slower than before. What I would like to stress is that these concerns are obviously shared by many countries, let's call them the OECD world, which used to be called the industrialized countries or the advanced market economies. Nevertheless, Europe has its own specific problems on the top of these factors. But I think we can investigate the specific European problems if we shift the focus from the absolute rate of growth towards the relative rates of economic growth in the contemporary world. Why? Because it would be very, very difficult and not necessarily productive to speculate about what is an optimum rate of growth. What would be a perfect rate of economic growth, which we all would like. I think it makes most sense to shift our attention to questions of how and what way economic growth turns out to be very uneven among different parts of the world and different regions. I would like to highlight four such relations, starting with the well-known one that the countries so-called BRICS are growing faster than the OECD world. Number two, that the USA has been growing faster in the last, let's say, quarter of a century than the European Union. Number three, that Eastern Europe in the recent 15 years has been growing faster than Western Europe. And finally, our host, Germany, has been growing faster than either France or Italy. I was wondering for a second whether I should put France or Italy on this page, and I thought it's better if I leave both, not least because I should stop for a second and ask you which one out of the four you would consider as good news, bad news, or neutral. And then, of course, the discussion can be very interesting. If Germany grows faster than some other countries, maybe people in this country and in this city and in this building would be tempted to say that this is good news. I think the evaluation of these four relations should rely on a deeper assessment of why growth rates in some groups of countries might be higher in certain period than elsewhere. Exactly because of the need for convergence, the need for less developed countries to catch up economically with the more advanced ones. And in many cases, we need to see that growth of these less developed countries is welcome news, is something which we should be happy about. So at least number one, BRICS growing faster than OECD, and number three, Eastern Europe growing faster than Western Europe, should be okay. It should not be a source of any kind of disappointment. These regions should catch up, should converge, but they should also converge qualitatively, not only in terms of the volume of the GDP. Now, we can have questions about why the EU economy has been growing slower than the USA in this long period, and obviously I would like to stress that we should even be concerned by the big gap between the growth performance and potential of Germany and other countries at the core of the Eurozone, as opposed to some other countries, especially in this case Italy. Between Germany and France, the gap would not be enormous. Sometimes this is even overemphasized. But if you compare Germany to Italy, of course, it becomes a major one. Here you can see it in a graphic way between six major economies. five European and one non-European, at the time of the crisis and the early phase of the recovery. It's so early phase of the recovery that for some countries it is not even a recovery, and that applies to Italy in particular. The country that recovers faster from the recent crisis is the United States of America. That's the dashed red line. And the best performer of the non-Americans on this chart is indeed Germany. And there is a major gap, not between Germany and France, but Germany and France on the one hand, let's say core countries of the Eurozone, and the more peripheral countries of the Eurozone, Spain and Italy, which would bring me to my first important point, that in Europe, in fact, if you want to specify what exactly is the problem, it's not growth in general. Of course, we measure it through the GDP, but the problem is the recovery capacity of the Eurozone economy in case of economic crisis, in case of an economic downturn. And of course, if it happens repeatedly that Europe recovers too slowly, Europe recovers much slower from crises as compared to the United States or other parts of the world, then of course this becomes a cumulative disadvantage. Here we go. If you look at the quarter of a century comparison between the United States and the European Union in terms of GDP, then you find that for most of the time, the U.S. growth was higher. There are some episodes when it was not the case. 9/11 consequences is one such episode. And the early phase of the great financial crisis, 2007, when it was pre-crisis in most of Europe, but it was already a financial crisis in the U.S. But otherwise, for most of the time, what we found is that the U.S. is growing faster. So there must be some fundamental weakness, which I believe is not simply the recovery capacity, but an overall bias in the European economic policy, which does not allow as fast economic growth as it would be possible, or as it is at least possible in the United States. Just one point, although I believe this is obvious about the East-West European comparison, this is a kind of post-crisis data, post-crisis for most of the European countries, when we see in 2014 and 15 Eurozone growth around 1%. This is not anymore crisis, but still growth is only 1% or just slightly more, while most of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe have growth rates between 2 and 3 and sometimes higher. And I would like to stress again that this is something we should welcome, that European Union membership allows the East European countries not only to integrate, but also to catch up. This is absolutely fundamentally important to allow these countries to converge. Now, here comes something which I need to stress when we go even more analytical, that in order to understand these discrepancies between East-West convergence and North-South divergence, we need to differentiate between two layers, two levels of the European integration. Because one, which is the East-West story, is largely about the capacity of the single market, which in EU is an integrated market with cohesion policy, which allows convergence to happen, while on the other hand, in the currency union, in the form it was invented in Maastricht, we face major obstacles for such convergence to happen. In fact, if convergence happens at the time of the crisis, it turns into divergence very quickly. Why is that? I would say it is exactly because in the single market, the four freedoms are supplemented by strong, effective cohesion policies. And social legislation also ensures that there are limitations to what we call the race to the bottom. On the other hand, if you look at the construction of the single currency, the currency union, which now includes 19 countries out of the 28 member states, we have a type of the currency union which has strong constraints on monetary and fiscal policies, one size fits all, if I want to simplify, but without the capacity to deal with asymmetries in this single currency zone and the cyclicality. These capacities are lacking, which results in a strong bias for internal devaluation in case a crisis comes, and the lack of competitiveness is diagnosed in various member states. This altogether results in a deepening of a core-periphery divergence inside the Eurozone. So in literature, you find the expression core and periphery applied to both East-West and North-South relations. However, the nature of this and the origin and the mechanism differs very significantly. In the East-West, what concerns core-periphery relations, I believe, although in a longer-term horizon, we can expect convergence, while without fundamental reforms, the core-periphery divergence will be a major concern inside the currency union. Because I want to speak more about inequality, I would like to skip these two slides and go a bit faster. This is just to sum up that in theory, there are obviously clear explanations and descriptions of the asymmetry between the Eastern countries and the Western world, despite being quite integrated in the single market. The income gap between the East and the West is not going away very quickly. It is getting reduced, but it's not going away very quickly, and then it will continue to make a strong impact on the flows of capital and the flows of labor. But still, outside the Eurozone, the Eastern member states have a greater scope for macroeconomic maneuver. And the recovery capacity is not so constrained as in peripheral countries inside the Eurozone. This is, again, pretty much the case in the North-South relations. The imbalances are not so enormous if you just look at the income levels. They exist, but not so enormous. However, let's call it minimalist monetary union, has the capacity to turn this minor diversity into divergence at the time of crisis, which in principle has various types of remedies, and you can easily find articles about what would need to be done. You can easily find official documents like the 4 presidents' report, the 5 presidents' report, maybe in 2 years' time the 6 presidents' report, about what should be done in order to deepen and consolidate the monetary union. But obviously there is a gap between the analysis, the diagnosis, and the practical application of the therapy. Now, this should allow me to jump into the question of income inequality. Why? Because, as I try to stress, the relative rates of economic growth are a lot more interesting than the absolute ones. But where the discussions have shifted, I think rightly in the recent period, is more the quality of growth and not necessarily the rate of the economic growth. And one of the key questions concerning the quality of growth is the inclusiveness. Now, a variety of institutions speak about inclusive growth. The World Bank and the IMF perhaps even compete in producing materials about the importance of making economic growth inclusive. In the European Union, we produced in 2010 the Europe 2020 strategy for smart, sustainable and inclusive growth, with the first time inclusion of a poverty reduction target in such an official long-term strategy for the EU. Now, inequality at that time was not as widely discussed as today. In fact, it's just partly a result of economic research and social research that we talk so much about inequality today. And on this front, Thomas Piketty, but also Joseph Stiglitz, Atkinson, so a few names, Branko Milanovic should not be forgotten. So there are a few names whose books have been published all around the world on this topic. And, of course, many of them have been working for a long time in this area. But somehow it's the last 2 or 3 years when the interest on inequality and its relation to growth exploded. I would say that there are at least two personalities outside economics who helped this to happen. Number one, Barack Obama, who started to speak about the importance of tackling inequality in order to generate a political atmosphere in the United States to increase the minimum wage substantially. When Germany, I would say rightly, introduced the minimum wage, it was already the increase of minimum wage in various U.S. states that was on the agenda. And the rhetoric of the U.S. president helped enormously. And on the other hand, Pope Francis, obviously being very, very important, not only in Europe, but in the entire Catholic world and beyond. Now, what can we say about income inequality in the European Union? Number one, that again, when I spoke about divergence, has become a significant trend. If you just aggregate everything and everybody in the European Union, this is not going to be detected, because on the level of the EU and maybe on the level of the Eurozone, the changes are not enormous. There are some countries, and I will show this in a minute, where inequality has increased, and in other countries where inequality has decreased, if we apply either Gini or the 80-20. It's not about the 1%, because probably the 1% is concentrating more and more income regardless. But if we look at either the Gini or the 80-20 indicators, then we can see, for example, in this particular case, that income inequality in Germany, for example, a core country of the Eurozone, either stagnated or fell. In Spain, a consequence of the crisis and the crisis response was that it increased significantly. If it's not about just two countries, but an aggregate of the Eurozone north and the Eurozone periphery, what you can see is that there was convergence in terms of income inequality before the crisis. Europe became more convergent, while the crisis and the crisis response policies resulted in a significant divergence of income inequality between countries. We have a country-by-country breakdown of this, and if you give me a few seconds, I will explain what you can see here. On the horizontal axis, what you can see is the level of income inequality in various EU countries in 2008, before the crisis time. So if countries are on the right, they already had high income inequality. And if they are on the left, like Slovakia or Slovenia, for example, they had less income inequality as compared to the European Union average. And the vertical axis means how it changed during the crisis. So there are countries, for example, the Netherlands or Belgium, where income inequality fell at the time of the crisis. So they are on the bottom half, and the top half, obviously, is the countries where income inequality grew at the time of the crisis. Now, the critical zone, and that's why it is circled with red, where income inequality was already high, and it continued to grow at the time of the crisis. Typically, you find countries like Spain or Greece, also Italy on the border line. So typically the countries of the Mediterranean which experienced what we call internal devaluation at the time of the crisis in the absence of other adjustment mechanisms. There is a different type of breakdown which then separates whether the changes in the income inequality is a product of changes in wages or changes in transfers. To save time, let me just say that in most cases, changes in wages happen to be the dominant factor also at the time of the crisis. There are a few outliers, and to my great sadness, you find that, for example, Hungary is an outlier, a non-Eurozone country, so the same issues which were in play in the Eurozone did not affect the country. Nevertheless, government redistribution changed in a way that increased income inequality massively. You know a few things about Hungary. Maybe you didn't know this one, but this is also one of the outcomes of the recent years, the growing income inequality, specifically because of the changes in the reforms of taxation and the benefit welfare system in the recent years. What the IMF and the World Bank rise today, and together with the OECD, don't forget the OECD, was also found by a commission in the Employment and Social Development report a few years ago, which you can see here, that there is some but significant correlation between the economic performance and income inequality, i.e. Less income inequality correlates with better gross performance at the time of the crisis. But I would admit that you can open a big discussion about this, why exactly this happens, and what are the limitations of this statement. But this correlation, if you want, is there. It can be highlighted that countries where income inequality is less, Austria, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, they had better gross rates than several others with higher income inequality. The consequences, of course, yes. The consequences, of course, are quite significant, which I believe you are familiar with and other speakers will surely speak about. So let me just jump into a few conclusions, first of all, repeats that the European Union has additional and specific problems in the context of the single market and the monetary union, which reformulate the question of growth as compared to many others. It's particularly important in the context of the north-south asymmetry, or at the time of the crisis, divergence. I would say that it's not so much the long-term gross potential, which is the main issue here, but the recovery capacity at the time of the crisis. But, of course, there is a major erosion of the long-term gross potential as well if this issue is not repaired. The EU can live with imbalances, but the Eurozone cannot live with such divergence. So that's why I would say that there is an urgency of the EMU reform, and at the same time, which we should also stress that reducing the imbalances and inequalities in the EU economy should help with improving the overall long-term growth potential of the EU. Thank you very much.